From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Noe Valley, San Francisco.
DuBose Triangle, Lower Haight.
Visitation Valley.
Downtown San Francisco.
Coming up, we seek human connection on the streets of San Francisco's Tenderloin.
I guess I would have just walked by her previously, but, you know, I just stopped and I talked to her.
Then, a new film may change the nature of your connection to a life-giving necessity, water.
It was funny because we were thinking, we need to find someone who's like the Aaron Brockovich, you know, of water issues. And then we were like, what about Aaron Brockovich?
And what happens to the children when abuse makes a house no longer a home?
The number one factor in how a child weathers exposure to domestic violence is having at least one stable, loving adult present in their lives.
That's today on Cross Currents. Stay tuned. The issue of domestic violence made Bay Area headlines when San Francisco Sheriff Ross Mirkarimi was suspended from office after pleading guilty to falsely imprisoning his wife, Eliana Lopez.
I know what violence, domestic violence is. And the real violence here is against me, is to put a family apart.
But besides that high-profile case, domestic violence rarely makes the news. It's often considered a private issue, only reaching the public after it's too late. Just over 36 years ago, there was nowhere a victim of domestic violence could go for help here in the Bay Area. So that's when a group of women banded together to start La Casa de las Madres, California's first domestic violence shelter and the nation's second. Today, the Home of the Mothers, as it translates in English, offers a range of crisis and intervention services, including an 8-week emergency shelter and a 24-hour crisis hotline, all free of charge. KALW's Holly Kernan spoke with Jamie Cox, the outreach and volunteer coordinator for La Casa de las Madres. She asked her to describe the types of people who count on La Casa's services.
So at La Casa de las Madres, we have a continuum of services and support for survivors and victims of domestic violence of all ages, all walks of life, because what we know is that domestic violence affects people from all backgrounds and all communities really at the same rates. And even elderly victims of abuse or victims of elder abuse, you know, when it's not an intimate partner, but abuse from a caregiver or an adult child. And our services range from, you know, 24-hour emergency shelter if someone feels in danger where they're living, and, you know, not just the safe roof over their head, but while they're there, really receiving counseling, attending support groups, working with a case manager around their individual needs, like finding a safe school for their child, you know, if they've really had to pick up and leave their lives. So sort of ranging from that to our drop-in center, where people can come really no matter where they're living. Maybe they're still with their partner, but they want support around building their stability, their safety, their options.
And La Casa de las Madres has been around for 35 years now. I imagine that the sort of political and cultural landscape has changed a lot around domestic violence. How has that evolved? What have you all seen kind of transpire?
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the major changes or shifts that we've seen is the increasing availability of services for survivors. And I think we're lucky in the San Francisco Bay Area compared to some communities in terms of what's available.
The resources that are available to women and
right.
families.
That being said, I think, you know, there's still a long way to go in terms of the community's understanding of this issue of, you know, how we treat someone when they come forward as a survivor, or the messages that we send to our children about what it means to be in a relationship. You know, what does a healthy relationship look like? I think just more broadly as a society, we still have a long way to go.
What are some of the things that you wish we knew?
Well, you know, there are a lot of myths out there about domestic violence, that it only happens in certain communities, in low-income communities or in communities of color or communities where maybe there isn't as much education. And there are myths like the myth that it's only physical.
But it's much harder to quantify if it's not physical, right?
Right. Well, and that's sort of reflected sometimes in the way that we, if you look at data around abuse and prevalence, it is hard to kind of quantify all of these other kinds of abuse, like sexual and emotional, verbal, economic. But I think that a real understanding of what it actually is and what it looks like for people and who it affects makes us that much more able to respond and to support survivors, and also to not stereotype and not sort of make assumptions about people that all men are batterers, let's say, or that all women are victims. That's another myth, that it's always happening in, you know, heterosexual married couples, whereas the rates are really the same among same-sex couples as well.
That's Jamie Cox. She's Outreach and Volunteer Coordinator for La Casa de las Madres, and you're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. Can you just give us a little bit of a sense of the scope and what domestic violence looks like here in the Bay Area? You've said that there's a lot of myths and stereotypes around it, but paint us a picture. What's going on here?
Sure. So in San Francisco, on average, every day, the emergency services, or 911, receives an average of 19 calls for help regarding domestic violence every day in San Francisco. And just since 2000... at least 30 domestic violence victims have been killed by their partners or their former partners in just this area locally. We also know that the U.S. Department of Justice estimates that around 40% of victims will never report their abuse. So, you know, on the sort of the broader level, roughly one in three women experience abuse at some point in their lifetime.
And what kind of abuse are you talking about?
That can include physical or sexual, emotional. When we talk about abuse at La Casa de las Madres, you know, we include any kind of control that a person can experience in a relationship.
But isn't there a danger if you broaden the definition so much that you water down the real, you know, grave cases of abuse that where you do need somebody to step in?
You know, there are definitely cases that are where the level of violence is more dangerous or more severe, and we definitely don't want to water that down at all or make light of that. You know, I think that when we expand the way that we think about this beyond that it's always physical or that it's only physical, we are so much more able to respond to people that really need help. Because so much of the time, someone may not have ever been hit, but they've been threatened, their life has been threatened, their economic resources have been taken from them, they've been isolated so that, you know, they're not able to maintain connections with their support systems. And all of these things can make someone very much at risk, even though they may not have ever been hit.
And Mother's Day is coming up this weekend. What are you doing around your Mother's Day campaign?
Well, the campaign is called In Celebration of Mothers. And a big part of this campaign is taking place in social media, on Facebook. We're asking the whole community to participate in spreading a message of gratitude for mothers and for all those who have given us strength, care, been our refuge, been our support. The mother role looks different in all of our lives, but really recognizing the importance of caring, stable adults for children and in all of our lives. For children who have witnessed domestic violence, the number one factor in how they weather that exposure is the presence of at least one stable, loving adult in their lives. So part of the campaign is about recognizing that important role that mothers and all adults play in helping to create futures free from violence for all of our children.
That's Jamie Cox, Outreach and Volunteer Coordinator for La Casa de las Madres. She spoke with KALW's Holly Kernan. La Casa's 24-hour crisis line is 1-877-503-1850. Again, that's 1-877-503-1850. You can find more information about their services and about how to get involved in their Mother's Day social media campaign at our website, KALW.org. And And joining me now is Martina Castro, our managing editor here on Cross Currents. Hey, Martina.
Hello, Hannah.
Hi. So that piece we just heard about La Casa de las Madres, you had something to do with that piece.
That's right. I produced it. When I saw a press release about their social media campaign around Mother's Day, I couldn't believe I knew nothing about this organization. Being the first domestic violence shelter in the state and among the first in the country 35 years ago, and it's right here in San Francisco. I was so pleased to be able to share information about that on our show and also show an example of one of the many nonprofits that depends so much on everybody getting involved. That's the theme of our membership campaign now that we're in, and I hope it inspires all of you to get involved right now in KALW. KALW.org is where you can do that, and we have many gifts for you to thank you for becoming involved and becoming a member. But really, I hope you can just take away some pleasure in knowing that you are a vital part of keeping this organization running, just like all the volunteers who give their time to keep that shelter running 365 days a year, 24 hours a day.
We know a little bit about volunteers helping run a station and a show, and it just feels very fulfilling that all these people are here because they want to be here. So why don't you be a part of this as well and get involved? Go to KALW.org right now. Pledge at any level you feel is comfortable for you. And we'd be happy, as Martina said, to send you a lovely gift in return.
And our volunteers are able to give their time. But right now is a moment that you get to get involved with your hard-earned dollars, which we respect are difficult to get by these days. But without them, we don't exist. So go right now to KALW.org and get involved.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. One San Francisco neighborhood that lives with a reputation of poverty, crime, and abuse is the Tenderloin, and that can make it a hard place for people to live. Almost a quarter of the neighborhood's residents live below the poverty line, and according to statistics from 2008, the neighborhood accounts for more than half of the city's drug-related offenses. Statistics like those make it easy to forget that the Tenderloin is also a historical landmark. After the 1906 earthquake, the neighborhood was rebuilt in the Beaux Arts style. Lots of arched windows and cornices, an entertainment district. It had restaurants and theaters, as well as the brothels and gambling joints. Movie director Frank Capra lived there. So did writer Dashiell Hammett. Boxer Muhammad Ali trained there. Miles Davis, Thelonious Monk, The Grateful Dead, and Jefferson Airplane all recorded some of their best-known work in Tenderloin Studios. A new documentary play called Tenderloin in the neighborhood's Cutting Ball Theater aims to find some of that old vibrancy on the Tenderloin's present-day streets. It's a documentary play, and the voices are of real-life people. Emily Wilson has the story.
As they have often over the past year, actors David Sonico and Rebecca Frank are walking the streets of the Tenderloin. It's a sunny Friday afternoon.
Oh, look, we got a crazy fight now. We got a fight going on in the corner. Club 21, I don't like to walk by Club 21. There always seems to be
that
some...
That looks like love.
Is that love going on there?
Love. It's hard to tell, but you...
Sometimes there's a thin line,
there
I
is
guess.
A really thin line in the Tenderloin.
Sonico and Frank are walking that thin line for their roles in the play Tenderloin, in which they play several of the neighborhood's real-life residents. The actors want to know what those people see every day and how they feel about it.
On the surface, there's a lot of not very positive stuff to see, like the drug addicts we just passed by who were literally passed out on the street. And, it's painful. It can be painful to look at how hard a life is for some people. We always think of that as existing in some far-off country or continent where we're also lucky here, but it's also right in our backyard. And at the same time, we're talking to a lot of people who talk about how much love there is among the residents of this neighborhood and the people who work here.
Sonico, who lives in Fairfax, has been performing in shows at the Cutting Ball Theater on Taylor Street for a decade. but he says he never really engaged with the neighborhood before starting to work on this play. As we walk, he and Frank pause in front of a mural on the corner of Turk and Jones.
So this is the same view of this corner, looking that way, just like if it was in spring and everything was a garden and there were no streets.
The mural depicts the neighborhood as it is, quite literally, says a man named TJ, who happens to be standing nearby.
You're in here?
Same sweater on right here on stage. You got the same sweater on right here.
What
stage
is that?
TJ. I was here when the lady done it, man.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
All right.
And the thing is about this, ain't nobody writing on it. They're not trying to desecrate it. Yeah, no tagging or nothing. So they're respecting it, yeah.
A little farther along, Sonico and Frank stop to point out a stately building on Eddy Street.
And here's a Hotel Cadillac here.
The hotel was built in the early 1900s and meant for wealthy visitors. Now it offers affordable housing and support services for low-income people. Husband and wife, Leroy and Kathy Looper, own the hotel together, along with several other halfway houses in the neighborhood. In the play, Sonico portrays the cheerful Kathy. Frank plays 87-year-old Leroy. Leroy died late 2011, and the play is dedicated to him. Frank remembers meeting him for the first time.
He was sort of this, like, magnetic, charismatic, wonderful, big personality. And he came from a personal experience of having been a drug addict and then saying that his philosophy was that people that had been through this could heal other drug addicts.
So part of what I do is I set up Reality House to stop the bull that was going down. Now when I call it bull, I mean the psychiatrists had their own vernacular, and I have my own way of talking, and my way is the penitentiary way and the street way. So they trusted me because I trust them.
Annie Elias created and directed the play.
But having done this form a few times now, I'm amazed by the wisdom and poetry of, I hate to use the term ordinary people, but people who aren't famous, just the voices of people on the street and people who are everyday life.
Like Jasper, a beatboxer living on the street.
I mean, it doesn't suck for some people because they've gone beyond confusion and lost their minds. But for me, I got all this personality, talent, intelligence and stuff, and my body, my health has been made to flourish. But my feet might get a little sore because I'm always on. But as far as like the condition of my entire being 100% healthy, I am.
Elias says the actors heard lots of surprising stories about people in the Tenderloin, such as this one, heard from a man named Nappy Chin.
One day she turns, she says, "Look, Nappy Chin, I'm going to jail, and I'm pregnant. So they're going to let me stay out here till I have this baby. But I don't want the baby to grow up in the system. So I know if I go to jail, they take the baby, they're going to put the baby in the system. So can I tell them it's your baby?" So I said, "Okay." Naturally, I wasn't thinking then.
The actors talked to more than 40 people, spending anywhere from 30 minutes to several hours hearing their stories. They transcribed all their interviews down to the uhs and the ums and carefully studied each person's body language and gestures. On stage, those people come to life. A high school senior, a police captain, a lawyer, a group of neighborhood kids, and a waitress at a transgender bar. Elias says since she's been working on the play, it's easier to see the love in the neighborhood and in the people there.
I just saw this older woman. She was in a wheelchair and she was trying to get up Taylor, you know, and it's a hill, you know. And I guess I would have just walked by her previously, but started working on this piece and really hearing people's stories, and, you know, I just stopped and I talked to her, and I, you know, it was just a moment of empathy. Oh, she's struggling to get up the damn hill, you know. So I pushed her up, and she was just so lovely, and we had this really lovely exchange, and she was very thankful, and I wish people would see the humanity here.
After an hour or so of walking, Sonico and Frank are back at the Cutting Ball Theater, ready to bring their experiences from the streets to the stage. In the Tenderloin, I'm Emily Wilson for Cross Currents.
Tenderloin is playing at the Cutting Ball Theater through June 3rd. Find more information at our website, kalw.org. And with me is Martina Castro, our managing editor here on Cross Currents. And we're in the middle of our May membership drive, and we want you, the listener, to get involved.
That's the theme of our campaign, and we are promoting that by bringing you stories about what it means to get involved. And this last story you just heard is emblematic of that. Instead of imagining a story that would be based in the Tenderloin, these artists went out into their community, interviewed real people, and are bringing those stories now to audiences from all around the Bay Area. It's that kind of getting involved that we want you to do right now. Go to kalw.org and become a member of this community organization. We are bringing you stories like that every day. We're not necessarily making theater out of them, but we are trying to tell you compelling stories about real people and about your community. So, In efforts to promote that, we are offering two pairs of tickets, just two pairs, to the show that was just covered in the story called Tenderloin. If you can give at the $75 level, you can take a pair of tickets with you.
All right. KALW.org is where you can get involved right now. If you've just kind of stumbled over our station, this is your chance to say, hey, I like that story. I'm willing to get involved and support reporting that brings me in-depth coverage of a place that is often, you know, reported about in the media, but in a grim manner. You hear the voices of the people who live in this neighborhood through this play, and it's called Tenderloin by Cutting Ball Theater, which is in the Tenderloin.
That's right.
So if you go to the website kalw.org and give at the $75 level, you can go see Tenderloin in the Tenderloin. kalw.org is where you need to go. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. It's our planet's most valuable resource. Cities are powered by it, wars are fought over it, and life depends on it.
We think of it as the air, infinite and inexhaustible. But when you use water in such quantities that it exceeds the capacity of the system to renew itself, we have a problem.
So goes the trailer for the new documentary film Last Call at the Oasis. It's made by the same producers who made Food, Inc. and An Inconvenient Truth, films that had us thinking about what we eat and how we treat the planet. Now they're back with a new film about our connection with water. The film's director is Palo Alto-born Jessica Yu. She recently came to KALW and spoke with Kevin Robinson.
Well, the film is a look at the water crisis, so it's issues of water shortage, issues of water quality, how that all fits together. But it's told through stories of people who are wrestling with these issues that all of us are really going to have to address at some point sooner or later.
Why should the Bay Area care about this type of film and the subject matter about water pollution, water conservation? Because we're surrounded by three sides. We got the Bay and we have the ocean. So there's plenty of water.
Yeah, right. Well, that's interesting that you say that. I mean, water problems, everything, what we found out is everything is interconnected when it has to do with water. But specifically, when you look at California, we've got some serious, serious water issues here. We're in some ways running on borrowed time. Like if you look at the Central Valley, right, that's where a fifth of our produce in this country is grown. The aquifer under that valley.
Which is the aquifer?
The aquifer, that's groundwater. That's where we're pumping. When we don't get enough rainfall, we're digging down and getting that water from there. What we found out is that that aquifer could be depleted in as little as 60 years. Well, that was one of those moments in making the film where I just couldn't, I was hard, a little hard to sleep wondering, what does that mean? What happens after that point? 60 years, that's within a lifetime, right?
Okay, yeah. You have some noteworthy speakers, I want to say maybe A-list people Aaron Brockovich, the champion of the little guy.
Yeah, Aaron Brockovich, she's amazing. I mean, we really... It was funny because we were thinking, we need to find someone who's like the Aaron Brockovich, you know, of water issues. And then we finally were like, what about Aaron Brockovich? For 20 years, she's been dealing with water contamination issues and cases. And she has a unique perspective in that people in communities across the country and now around the world, they're contacting her because they're not able to rely on the agencies that are supposed to be handling these cases. And so... they're thinking, who can help us? And they're going to Aaron Brockovich. So she gets thousands of emails every week of people saying, okay, you know, our water is green, something smells funny, our livestock are getting sick, what's going on? So her point is that communities need to communicate with each other. We've got to have power numbers. We've got to share information rather than rely on agencies or think that Aaron Brockovich can save us, you know? So that's, I think, where she's hoping that this will all go.
You also see some people in the film who are just everyday mothers and fathers and, yeah, and daughters and husbands and wives. Is it Sissy Sather? Is that her name?
Sather, yeah.
Out of, is it Midland, Texas?
Yeah.
And she approaches Aaron about the pollution in her groundwater.
Yeah.
I think we have a clip from that.
Sure. Say. Well, so... Sissy was noticing that the water in the pool was green. She has an above-ground pool. And so she emailed Aaron Brockovich because she knew, you know, something wasn't right. And Aaron was able to immediately figure out what it was.
Okay. Let's take a listen.
Oh, my gosh. The biggest scene was when she's talking to the lady and she looks out there and her kids are playing in the pool. That's how I felt when I realized that I had been putting my grandkids in toxic water in that swimming pool. It was very, very emotional for me.
So Josie Minow is Jessica Yu. She's the filmmaker of the new film, Last Call at the Oasis. Jessica, so in that scene right there, there's a scene from the movie Aaron Brockovich and also with Sissy Sather.
Right. And so the chemical they're talking about, hexavalent chromium, so it's a very eerie echo of the film Aaron Brockovich, where that was the chemical contaminant. And in Midland, Texas, they're also having a very intense case of this in this community, and a lot of illness, cancer, dogs with tumors. I mean, you name it. There's and the real struggle is to figure out how to clean up this contamination. They say that this chemical stays in the system for, you know, 400 years. I mean, basically forever. And also how to hold someone responsible for the pollution. So that's the real struggle that's happening on the ground there.
One thing you mentioned is that you said there's agencies who are ill-equipped to enforce the regulations. You meaning, for instance, the Environmental Protection Agency?
Yeah. I mean, in the film, it's interesting because the EPA, they're not the bad guy, but their situation is really pointing to the fact that they're not funded, they're not supported, they don't have the legislative tools also to go after these cases. And if you look at what Aaron Brockovich sees, what she's hearing from communities across the country, it's like David and Goliath popping up in every state. It's really, really tough to make things right when we have these kind of water contamination issues.
Can you mention there's something in the film that talked about the Halliburton loophole.
Right.
What is that?
The Halliburton loophole was an exemption that was created so that the natural gas industry could be exempt from some provisions of the Clean Water Act. So the idea was that in, say, fracking, that the companies did not have to disclose what...
And fracking is when you go down and split shale rock.
Sorry. That's right, okay. Yes. Well, a lot of water is used to frack, to cause, you know, underground fractures to release natural gas. That's the simplest way to explain it. And a lot of chemicals are used also in this. So you have a lot of water, a lot of chemicals. And the idea is that since it was going under, you know, so far and beneath the ground, it was kind of exempted from the environment. And so the fact that companies don't have to reveal what chemicals they use makes it that much harder to trace when a contamination happens, where it came from. So that's the real difficult problem that communities are facing, in that they can't point to where the source is.
So that's a big problem. Obviously, having chemicals released into the water. And here's another clip from Last Call at the Oasis.
In the 5 years between 2004 and 2009, the Clean Water Act was violated 500,000 times. The old pollution was a river on fire. The new pollution is something you can't even see.
Whether it's birth control pills, erectile dysfunction medicines, hormone supplements, our bodies absorb some of them. We excrete the rest of the chemicals. We flush them away. They go to the treatment plant, and they are not removed.
Consider vast Lake Mead. Tests have found trace levels of birth control, steroids, narcotics, and more.
The U.S. is the leading producer of these new contaminants. We don't know how harmful these chemicals are, and there are more added all the time.
That was a clip from Last Call to Oasis. Joining me now is filmmaker Jessica Yu. Jessica, who were the two gentlemen speaking in that clip?
The two were Alex Prudhomme, who wrote a book called The Ripple Effect, and Robert Glennon, who's a water law professor who is also a great resource for the film.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people realize that, yeah, I mean, if you don't finish your medicine or you take a medicine, you can only use so much, the rest gets excreted out. Where does it go? It goes back into the water supply.
Yeah, this whole issue of trace contaminants is freaky, right? I mean, the thought that we have these things that we can't see, that we're not extracting from the water, but over our lifetime we could be ingesting every day. That's something that we're not really dealing with that. That, in addition to the fact that we use over 80,000 chemicals in this country, and only 5 are regulated by the Toxic Substances Control Act. So somehow. I think it's one of those things where you think, down the line, are we going to look back and think, what were we thinking?
That was Jessica Yu, director of Last Call at the Oasis, speaking with Kevin Robinson. Kevin runs the website Medium Rare, which highlights women and people of color in the television, film, and gaming industries. You can see the film tomorrow in 2 showings, 1 in San Francisco and 1 in Berkeley. All the details are at KALW.org. And with me is Martina Castro, our managing editor here on Cross Currents, during our May membership drive here at KALW, getting involved.
That's the theme. And there's nothing that makes me want to get more involved than interviews like the one we just heard.
Right.
You know, that was about water use and how important it is to respect this amazing, valuable resource that we have and that is scarce. And those same producers brought us movies like Food, Inc. and An Inconvenient Truth, all films that really allow you to see things you take for granted in your life in a totally new light. And that's what I think is the strongest sort of message that we want to send out to you, is this is what we want to do for you every day. I hope that you tune into Cross Currents for this type of coverage. And if you've never become a member, if you've just been listening up until now, this is the moment. Go to KALW.org. We only come to you a few times a year to ask for your support and to ask you to get involved. And this is the best way to do it.
KALW.org. Go there right now. And I'm saying now because if you go right now to KALW.org and pledge at the $75 level, we can send you to the film we just heard about, Last Call at the Oasis. Opening week starts tomorrow, and we can send you to it for a pledge of $75 for 2 tickets during opening week. Can't get better than that.
Yeah, that's at the Landmark Embarcadero Theater in San Francisco. That's KALW.org to get those tickets. And those aren't the only tickets available right now. We are giving you an opportunity to also go see Tenderloin, one of the recent works at the Cutting Ball Theater in the Tenderloin. We just had a story earlier in the show about this amazing theater work that not only is bringing to life many of the stories from the Tenderloin and the community there, but it's directly linked to real life stories. And that's kind of what we try to do here in Cross Currents. You know, it's not theater. We're trying to tell you very compelling stories that relate directly to the real lives of the Bay Area community. So if you are interested in hearing more of these stories, if you want to become involved in our community, right now's the moment to do it.
KALW.org. Go to the website and click on the piece itself. You know, you can listen to it while you make your donation. $75 will get you a pair of tickets to either Last Call at the Oasis, the film we heard about earlier in the show, or the play Tenderloin. Both very compelling. Yours for $75, a pair of tickets at KALW.org. Another thing you can get for $75 is this. The music you're hearing is by the Tia Fuller Quartet. They're playing at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts next Thursday night as part of the San Francisco Jazz Festival. Here, listen to that.
We love to feature local music and local festivals like the SF Jazz Festival. At the end of every show, we bring you local musicians from all around the Bay Area. Now you can go see them live. And that's because the theme of our campaign is get involved. We don't want to only ask you to talk to us and let us know that you love our programming, that you want this type of storytelling to keep going on KALW. But we're also, as a thank you gift, going to send you out into the community to get to know it better, because that's what we're all about here. So go to KALW.org and get involved in the KALW community.
You know, Martina, we only have 4 tickets to this, 2 pairs of tickets as premiums for the Tia Fuller Quartet at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, Thursday, May 17th at 7:30. So make sure before you go to sleep tonight to go to KALW.org, make that $75 donation, and pick your experience from today's show that you would like to go to. You can go to Last Call at the Oasis, you can go to the play Tenderloin, or you can get the music, musical experience of the Tia Fuller Quartet at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts on Thursday, May 17th. Pick any one of those, but more importantly, become involved. And Martina, thanks for joining me today.
You're so welcome.
For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.